Jesus Asked. Episode 17 is the beginning of chapter 8. How not to answer Jesus' questions. I don't remember where. Somewhere that English isn't the first language, like Switzerland or Romania or a breakfast place in central London, I once saw a sign that read, "No smoking is permitted." Now the intriguing thing is that if the first two words hadn't been hyphenated, the meaning would be clear. "No smoking is permitted" means the same thing as "smoking is not permitted." That is, no instance of this behavior, smoking, is allowed. But with the hyphen there, the ambiguity of the sentence is highlighted. Although none of the words have changed, the small addition of the hyphen means that the text should really be read as the behavior of "no smoking will be permitted." And nothing is said about the behavior of smoking, and whether or not that is also permitted. It sort of reminds me of the time some cartoon strip character defended himself to the policeman. "But officer, the sign said that this spot was fine for parking." Sometimes being able to take something two different ways is an advantage. You want to say both things at once. I was told of one academic who reviewed a book with which he disagreed. He knew that he would assign it to all his students to teach them to refute it. So he wrote his review and was quoted on the back cover, "This is an incredible resource for students." And he meant, of course, not that it was incredibly good, but that it had no credibility. The title of this chapter, "How Not to Answer Jesus' Questions," is offered up in that spirit of ambiguity. On the one hand, it might be read, "What you must not do when you're trying to answer Jesus' questions." But on the other, it might also be rendered, "How to sidestep Jesus' questions." And in a way, this chapter will be about both those things. But asking about the truth must be good and noble. Why would anyone avoid answering Jesus' questions? Well, two reasons: inconvenience and self-image. Difficult questions are, well, difficult. Just think about diet or exercise or ethical investing. You know what's good for you and what will feel great in the long term, but that's no guarantee you can face up to the short-term pain. It takes a lot of energy to answer hard questions, and it may take even more to work through and change your life according to what you find. And on top of the possibility of having to change, you may also need to acknowledge that up till now you've been wrong. So it should come as no surprise that many people who hear the questions of Jesus wish they hadn't. In a way, this chapter will be about both of those things. Earlier in the book, we looked at a story from Luke 20, in which Jesus was asked, essentially, "Who said you could do this?" If someone wheeled in a wooden cart and started selling farm-grown produce near the main entrance of your supermarket, it wouldn't be long before some store manager came out and asked, "Who gave you permission to do this?" The chief priests were similarly protective of teaching in the temple. But, as we've seen, instead of answering, Jesus asked a deceptively similar question back. He asked about John the Baptist. And interestingly, Jesus had another possible tactic that he did not take. In the Gospels, he does not ask, "Did you give permission for J the B to do what he did?" When they answered no, Jesus could then have said, "Neither do I need your permission." Instead, his question is whether John operated under the authority of human beings or under the authority of God. He wanted to set up a contrast between those two types of authority. Through the choice of tactic, between the lines of his question, he is saying something about the possibilities of his authority, rather than merely providing or proving his independence from the institutions and authorities of his day. Jesus' question is brilliant. But for the purpose of this chapter, the most significant thing is the answer that Jesus received, or rather, Even more important is the method by which the chiefs and elders came up with their answer. Their answer, you may remember, was, "We don't know." They claim they don't know whether they think John's message was of earthly or heavenly origin. Now, religion is their job. John the Baptist was obviously a religious, although also a political figure. Is it really credible that they should not have an opinion on this matter? When they discuss the question among themselves, it's striking that they do not ask themselves about John, or his work, or his message, at all. You'd think they would. Earlier, I compared their method of deliberation with my own chess-playing calculations. If I go here, he goes there. I take that, he takes that. No, that doesn't work. And that's just how the big shots in this story act when they say, if we say John's message was from heaven, he'll ask why we didn't follow him. But if we say his message was merely human, we'll get in trouble with these people. So out loud, they answered, "We don't know." They don't know because they haven't tried to face the question. They do not concern themselves with trying to come up with an answer that conforms to the truth of the matter. They instead concern themselves with forging an answer that avoids producing unpleasant consequences. You see, their first duty wasn't to the truth of the answer, but to the practical implications for themselves. Virtually any reader today will connect the leader's behavior with politicians even more strongly than with chess players, although the element of calculation links them both. Politicians in interviews tend to listen not for questions, but for opportunities. They don't hear what you're asking, but rather what they want to say, or rather what they want to be seen as saying. They have learned to concern themselves not with answering according to what they think is the reality, but according to what they judge will do them the most good. Is software company X a monopoly that has harmed the public and reduced competition in the industry? Is a question that is sometimes answered not on the basis of the number of competitor word processors that have survived and are still on the market, but rather on the basis of tax and advertising revenue and campaign donations. Isn't this what Jesus called pleasing people rather than God? So facing a question and simply ducking it isn't good enough. Jesus himself does that, although in the process manages to signal the answer to any perceptive observers. Nor is giving no answer sufficient. Rather, the best way not to answer Jesus is to avoid facing the question, at least facing it on its own merits. Meditate on the effect that answering will have on you, rather than on the subject matter at hand. And we find another wonderful example of this behavior in the book of the Acts of the Apostles, Luke's sequel to his gospel. Chapters 3 and 4 relate an incident that takes place in the time after Jesus. Peter and John, Jesus' disciples, found themselves lacking ready cash when a handicapped beggar asked for change. So they shrugged their shoulders, apologized, and healed the poor guy instead. But they did this in the temple courts, and that drew a crowd. And then, as in the story above from the Gospels, they began to teach this crowd in the temple, to teach them on the chief priest's turf. And we know how much temple bureaucrats smiled upon unplanned and unauthorized events like that. So Peter and John were arrested. They spent the night in jail, and in the morning were brought before the splendid masters of Jerusalem. Now, first century jails were not known for their comfortable sleeping quarters, nor for the range of facilities for freshening up in the mornings. The writer means for us to notice the contrast between the wealthy and powerful council members and the hungry, dirty, smelly Galilean prisoners. There's another contrast that the author means for us to notice, but which most readers do not. If this were a movie or a play, or if the whole of Luke Acts were read aloud to you, as was probably originally intended by the author, you wouldn't be able to avoid noticing the striking similarities and contrasts between this scene and one that happened near the end of the Gospels. Peter has been to this building before. Last time, however, Jesus was on trial inside, and a fearful Peter was cowering outside, making up lies because he was afraid of the high priest's servant girl. "I tell you, I don't know him," Luke 22:54-62. This time, it's Peter himself in the hot seat, face to face with the big cheese, not some chambermaid. Now Peter and John were arrested, not for being Christians. They had been arrested for causing a ruckus in the temple and for teaching about the resurrection, which the Sadducees, the party most concerned with the temple, did not believe in. The council that morning had probably only been told about the unauthorized disturbance that Peter and John caused, and this helps to explain the gift of a straight line that the high priest blundered into handing to Peter. By what power or name did you do this? The question is just like that other question to Jesus in his lifetime. Essentially, it's the big guys asking the rebels, "Who said you could do this?" The high priest was not asking a genuine question to Peter here. It's like the time Mr. Davidovich asked me, "Who exactly gave you permission to dangle the resuscitation dummy outside the third grader's window?" The council thought they knew exactly how naughty little Peter would have to answer. The high priest is the authority. It is his permission that these nobodies should have sought before gathering such a crowd and preaching such messages into the temple. According to the script, Peter should have crumpled at this point and stuttered, "No one gave us permission, Your Excellency. No one. 1,000 pardons. It will not happen again." But, unwittingly, he handed Peter some beautiful openings, and, somewhat surprisingly when you remember his previous denial of Jesus in the courtyard, Peter used every single opportunity to the max, just as his master Jesus might have. More next time. You've been listening to one of my books called Jesus Asked. Zondervan gave me permission to read you the whole book in weekly episodes. To subscribe or to get the other episodes, just fire up the iTunes Music Store and search for GEMPF, G-E-M-P-F, and then click on the picture. You can also get the MP3s from my website. Just do a web search with the words GEMPF and podcast. This book and my others are available from Amazon. The synthesizer background music is by William Fields at teamtechno.com, used through the Creative Commons licensing scheme. The acoustic surf guitar music is used with the permission of Paul Johnson of the Duotones. Visit him at pjmoto.com. Thanks for listening.